You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Adventurer podcast, where explorers and adventurers tell their stories. Coming up.
You look at the clouds and the mountains all around you and you sort of say, okay, what are they doing? Does it look like the weather's going to change? Do I feel safe? Where am I going to blow if things go wrong? And one of these, we got out by about 2 kilometres and it went from sort of 20 knots of wind to sort of 45, 50 knots of wind. And very quickly that builds the sea up to sort of 2 metres, it's breaking. You've got spindrift, these little tornadoes coming past you. And that feels pretty extreme when you're in the boat.
I'm John Horsfall, and on this weekly podcast, we talk to adventurers and explorers from around the world who have made remarkable and daring journeys in recent years. From Everest climbers to polar explorers, world record holders, and many more. I hope this podcast sparks ideas and inspires you to explore and go on an adventure of your own. But before we start, if you're enjoying the show, sign up to our monthly newsletter at zebraadventures.com, where I'll show you behind the scenes, I do giveaways, and offering you the opportunity to come on an adventure. My next guest was voted UK Adventurer of the Year for his 364-day expedition of Scotland by kayak and his continuous ascent of the 282 Monroe Mountains. His adventures have taken him across the world. He has crossed Iceland and done several expeditions to kayak the Patagonian fjords. On today's show, we are talking about his trip to Patagonia and Scotland with some kayaking tips for you this summer. I am delighted to introduce Will Copestake to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, man. Good to be on.
Well, absolute pleasure. I've been really interested to sort of learn a bit more about your stories and adventures. I sort of came across you recently, and I have to say, your kayaking trips, the photography and film that you do is spectacular. And I'm really intrigued to sort of get into your stories about Patagonia and Norway. But let's start with how you got into this kayaking adventures.
I'm really lucky, actually. So where I live is a small town, it's Ullapool in the far northwest of Scotland. The bottom of my garden was the sea growing up. And ironically, I grew up in dinghy sailing. My dad's really into his sailing. And spent most of my time sailing dinghies around the loch. And ironically, I've become a really rubbish sailor. But on a sort of side note of that, I ended up getting into paddling and sort of really dove into that pretty full on.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so I suppose being up in Scotland, you were always, growing up as a kid, you had the sort of outdoors to really express yourself. What was it about kayaking that you sort of took such a keen interest in?
So for me, it was, I've always loved playing in water. Initially for me, kayaking, I started as a whitewater paddler more than a sea kayaker, which I tend to do more of nowadays. And it was simply because there was someone a little bit older than me at school who we all thought was quite cool. And he was willing to take me and my best mate out in riverboats and just chuck us off stuff. Probably spent more time swimming than I did paddling. And he would pick us up at the bottom and sort of like, right, try it this time. Try not to do that this time. Oh, that was good. Try that. And then sea kayaking didn't really come until later, seriously, after university. And for me, I really love that ability in a sea kayak to go very far, very remote, but pack relatively comfortable things. If you go for a week, you can pack nice food and you can pack sort of comforts. If you're going more minimal like you would for hiking, you can go for a month or more and get all that stuff in a boat.
Good. And so your first, well, as I said earlier, you know, you've done these incredible trips in sort of Patagonia and Norway with some of the, I suppose, being in a kayak, you can go to these sort of remote beaches, which are so hard to sort of get to. What was it about Patagonia which sort of inspired you to do your kayaking trip there?
So Patagonia is the most amazing place. It's, for me, kind of like Scotland on steroids a little bit. It's the mountains are a little bit bigger. The wilderness is just a little bit wilder. The weather is fierce out there. It's famously very windy. As a sea kayaker, that's probably your worst enemy is wind. And if you combine all those challenges, it makes a really alluring place to go and paddle. As an expedition, I actually went down there first as a guide and sort of cut my teeth in kayak guiding for the first time in Patagonia. And it was two seasons there where, you as a guide, you're basically going around the same river. Or you're in sea kayaks, but we were on a river system. And you would go round and round and round, always looking at the mountains that you knew behind thousands of miles of fjord that basically no one can get to unless you've got a boat. And that is really alluring to go and sort of know what's on the other side of those mountains. And so the end of the second season, that was the kind of the kickoff point to go and start doing these big expeditions out there, was that kind of curiosity to see what lay beyond those and to go and explore it by kayak.
So were you doing that alone?
No. So I have done a few trips alone in Patagonia, none more than 3 or 4 days. The Navy there basically are the sort of the key holder to the fjords and the sea and the rivers. Unlike in the UK or in a lot of Europe, anything you do in Chile on the water needs naval permission. That's largely because they're your free rescue service, and it is incredibly difficult for them to rescue you in a lot of these places. And so it takes months of preparation to go through and get these permissions to go there. And one of those stipends is no solo trips. You do have to have a partner. And so my best friend from the north, Seamus Nairn, comes down, and he normally flies down at the end of my season and joins me. And we go off and do these sort of big long trips together.
How did it sort of all start? Were you sort of weaving in and around the sort of fjords of Patagonia, or was it very much a sort of a route of which sort of a historic route that someone's taken that you wanted to follow?
So a little bit of both, actually. The route itself has got not any significance in a sort of the route we chose. However, parts of that followed on with some of the original native tribes' portages. Now the tribes out there, the Kueskar, the Yaman, they were the people that Tierra del Fuego got its name from, the land of fire. It was their fires on the beaches that the early explorers saw and named it the land of fire. And these people were incredible. They lived basically naked in the equivalent of a Scottish winter. So this sort of rain and wind, and it's sort of plus minus 5 degrees. And they survived by putting seal fat on themselves and lighting a fire in their canoes on a bed of clay and navigating these fjords. And they would portage between the rough sections where you could. And so our route included some of these to add in. In terms of our actual route choice, it's a linear journey that we've been doing now over two expeditions. We're going to hopefully finish it off with a third that we had to cancel last year. That's basically gone from the north to the south through the fjords, and not in the most linear way, taking detours here and there to go and see the big glaciers that are tucked in the back of some of these fjords, which is what you really want to see, because the glaciers are very impressive.
Yeah. Did you dabble in seal fat? Did you strip off and?
Yeah, good bit of butter on there. keeps it nice and clean. No, I mean we did eat a lot of butter though. So every day you'll eat a sort of half a kilo of butter in your meals, which is obscene. But yeah, no, definitely not. The seals there are big and scary, and you don't really want to go anywhere near them. In fact, I can show you here that as a comparison. This is a Scottish seal tooth, for those who can see on camera.
You wouldn't want that going through you.
No, so that's a Scottish one. That's the Magellanic fur seal. So they're fairly.
There's quite a significant
meaty
difference.
Yeah.
There.
and if you think how big our seals are, they're big old creatures. So
I mean, what really is that? A couple of inch tooth?
Yeah, it must be what, 2.5-3 inches on there.
Which
is just big enough.
Good. And so, I mean, we had Katie on episode 20. She was talking about her trip of Patagonia, which she sort of said, there's such a famous sort of quote, and I'll probably absolutely butcher it, but it was something like, the scenery is taken from heaven and the wind's taken from hell, or something along those lines. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Landscape from heaven carved from the winds of hell. I think you see it on a lot of brochures down there. I mean, it's true. I mean, it is. It's hellish weather, but the landscape is heavenly.
Yeah. No, I mean, some of your photography, because you're a very talented photographer, and some of the shots that you've got are absolutely incredible. I mean, certainly makes me want to whip out the brochure and plan an expedition down there.
Yeah, I mean, we're really lucky to be able to get to these places. And what you don't see behind those amazing shots is the many, many days of not particularly amazing weather. But Patagonia is one of these places you can basically point a camera anywhere and you're going to get something pretty decent. It's a very photogenic place.
Yeah. So how long was that expedition?
So the first of those expeditions through the fjords was 33 days. We packed for 45. Because of that hellish wind and weather, you don't know if you're going to get caught in one of these mega storms where you just cannot get out on the water safely. And you're talking kind of 50, 60 mile an hour winds plus on a fairly regular time period. So you're planning quite a bit of extra time. We got really lucky with the weather on our first one, so we shaved 10 days off our planned time. And then the second trip, we planned, I think, for about 3 weeks, and it took us 16 days in total. It was, again, a little bit under time, which is what you want. You don't want to end up having a ration on things.
I mean, the fact that you can just hold a camera anywhere and capture these sort of spectacular moments. Were there any sort of moments along the way which you can look back and think, wow, that particular moment is just something that you can sort of cherish for the rest of your life?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's some of the days, particularly on the first trip, Seamus Nairn, his last name, we've called this effect the Nairn effect, in that for Seamus, it was his first ever expedition, this first trip we did. And we had three kind of jewel in the crown points, so amazing glaciers. And every single time we had horrible weather between them. And when you arrived at these jewels in the crown, it suddenly the wind dropped and the sun came out. And it was just glorious. And the middle fjord particularly, we were as remote as you can get, sort of over 350, 400K from the nearest road. And just glaciers everywhere, perfect weather, and just glorious paddling. And that sort of memory and feeling of remoteness, I think, will cherish for the rest of my life.
Oh, wow. God. I mean, being in lockdown in the UK is certainly one for the imagination. And I suppose with the sort of terrible weather and with the challenging weather conditions, there must have been some times. Were there a few sort of hairy moments along the way where you were like, whoa?
There's definitely a few that caught us out a little bit. Again, with the wind being sort of the key one there. We only really got caught out once, which was on a crossing. There's a few big open crossings that we had to commit to. And you take it really seriously. There's no proper weather forecasting out there. So when you get to these crossings that are going to take you an hour or two to get over, you look at the clouds and the mountains all around you and you sort of say, okay, what are they doing? Does it look like the weather's going to change? Do I feel safe? Where am I going to blow if things go wrong? And one of these, we got out by about 2 kilometres, and it went from sort of 20 knots of wind to sort of 45, 50 knots of wind. And very quickly that built the sea up to sort of 2 metres. It's breaking. You've got spin drift, these little tornadoes coming past you. And that feels pretty extreme when you're in the boat. It's interesting as well, because those waves, as a kayaker, as a sort of an experienced paddler, 2 meters is not big for a wave. It feels big, but it's very manageable. But with those winds, what you end up with is a very steep 2 meters, and it caps off at the top. And then from that capping off at the top, the wind is blowing you hellishly sideways. And so you're more bracing and steering and just trying to keep the boat on track. Thankfully, that wind was behind us, which was nice. And it just launches you down into the fjords. We basically got blown across this big open crossing, and thankfully found shelter in the islands behind.
God, that must have been such a relief to sort of get into those shelters away from the sort of storm.
Yeah, it gives your mind a lot of time to rest as much as the body. And it's always funny because you could see this storm coming as soon as it started to build. We got out and you suddenly saw this wall of wind coming and you thought, ah, oh dear. and then suddenly, yeah, sort of going, right, we've got to get to that point, which at this point was about a 40-minute paddle away. And as soon as you get in there, it is a bit of a like, right, let's stop and have a chocolate bar. That's a relief now.
Because I imagine you're sort of there weighing up. You're sort of like, is it going to move? Is it not? And then suddenly you're like, right, let's go for it. And because in sort of mountainous conditions, the weather can change so quickly. Probably, yeah, as you say, after sort of 20, 30 minutes, you're like, bugger.
Yeah, and yeah, okay. Actually, Patagonia, apart from being sort of high in mountains, it's the only place I've ever seen weather change that quickly. I mean, it can literally go from sunshine and no wind to snowing and sort of 20, 30 knots in less than a minute. And it's amazing how those sort of fronts suddenly go bang and they're just on. It's a very digital wind and it can sort of go bang and stop as well, which you'd hope for when it happens.
So your plan is to go back there?
Yes. So like I say, we've done 2 trips so far, linking sort of start to finish of each trip. So we're doing this very long linear journey through. And we could do it very quickly, but the idea is to sort of take your time and really see what's out there. And we had one planned. We're less than a week away from executing it, in fact, last March. Almost, actually, tomorrow would be a year ago today that we suddenly sort of said, yeah, that's not going to happen and we've got to go home and isolate now. And I was in Chile at that point.
Wow.
And we were hoping to link up another 850-kilometre journey south through the Strait of Magellan into the Beagle Channel through one of these Cuescar portages, and then proceed down and round Cape Horn and come back again, which would have been a real fun adventure. And one we still hope to do as well.
Yeah, when it all quietens down in a few, yeah, well, hopefully yeah, a few months.
Yeah.
We're nearly there.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems we're over the hump.
And so I suppose people are probably listening, wondering, you know, would you recommend this sort of trip for the average person, for a kayaker?
For an average paddler, probably not, unless you've sort of done a couple of other expeditions first, or have someone in the group that's experienced with dealing with those sort of conditions. For an experienced paddler, I would absolutely recommend it. It's a superb trip, but it is definitely not one to kind of cut your teeth on as a first expedition, because it is a very, very remote place and quite demanding. But yeah, if you're feeling confident and experienced, it's an amazing part of the world. Worth the hassle to get the naval permission. It's incredible.
Yeah, it just does look one of the most breathtaking places in the world.
Yeah, yeah, and it does claim people. There's normally a few deaths a year in Chile.
And so from there, you came back to Europe, and you were sort of pursuing different sort of kayaking trips each year from like Norway to Scotland, because your Scotland trip sounds quite interesting.
Yeah.
Can you for people listening, it's probably best you sort of describe what the sort of purpose of that Scotland trip was.
Yeah, so my Scotland trip sort of precludes the Patagonia stuff, and that started when I left university. I'd done a couple of small on-foot expeditions overseas in Iceland, New Zealand, and had always been asked about my home country and how much can you really say about your home country. For me, I could talk very well about a small pocket in the north and very well around the kind of pocket where I was at Stirling University. But the rest of the country I really had very little idea about. And so the idea was to try and circumnavigate the country by sea kayak and then come north again through the Munro Mountains, which are 282 peaks over 3,000 feet. And the idea was that by coast and mountain and cycling between those as I went up, it would cover pretty much everything in Scotland. I now realise that there's an awful lot more to cover, but it gave a pretty good sort of taster for sure.
Yeah, we had Emily Scott on an episode 9, and she ran and cycled this sort of 282 Munros.
Yeah, she did it very quickly. She did a really good job of that.
She absolutely nailed it. And you were sort of doing the same, running up, cycling up, all around.
Yeah. So when the kayaking kind of came first, and of that, I did 21 of the Munros as I passed on the kayak, because they're the sort of the logical ones you access by the sea. And then by the time I'd finished that, it was September, and so I was coming through the Munros mostly through the winter. And as a result of that, you kind of cycle in with a bike, base camp, and then do circuits of 2 to 4 days going through big rounds of them and coming back to the bike and then cycling to the next sort of base camp and doing another big circuit and coming round. And because I was kind of solo and on my own most of the time, you had to make circuits. You couldn't sort of do linear things. And much like I think Emily did, she sort of did lots of circuits.
Yeah. No, she said it was a really, really amazing sort of experience, because as you say, very rarely do you get to appreciate a lot of your own country in such different sort of pockets. Like every single place has their own sort of unique quality. And with 282 Munros dotted around Scotland, you certainly got to experience quite a fair chunk of it.
Yeah, I think that there's a certain magic in doing a continual round of Munros. You get to a summit, and if you are lucky enough to have a nice view, you're looking at probably the next 40, 50 mountains you've got to climb, and you're looking back at 40, 50 that you've just climbed. And you aren't actually traveling massive distances a lot of the time. So you're kind of doing a few mountains here, and then you're maybe going 5 miles, and then you're doing the next 5 mountains or so. So you get the same view from many different angles. While facing this kind of daunting view to the north, going, oh my goodness, there's loads. And then this very satisfying view to the south, saying, yeah, I've done those now. It's quite a unique feeling.
And so that Scottish trip, that took, what was the good part of a year, wasn't it?
Yeah, by complete and utter coincidence, one day short of a year, which was not planned. It was supposed to take 10 months. The kayaking was about the right amount of time that I'd planned, and then the mountains, it was one of the worst recorded winters on record, and that really slowed me down. I think we had sort of 12 major storm fronts come through in the space of 6 months, and it was pretty brutal.
Well, after Patagonia, I don't know what you're complaining about.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Patagonia compares very well with it. It's a logical next step.
Yeah, I have to say, I lived up in Scotland for a bit, and yeah, the weather can turn pretty bad pretty quickly.
Yeah, it really can be.
Good. And then I suppose you've sort of been doing these sort of kayaking trips just every sort of year or so, going to a new place, experiencing it. And is your sort of intentions just to keep sort of traveling every sort of part of the world with this? Because it's such an amazing way to explore. And so you could literally just pick a country on the coast and say, right, I'm just going weaving up Norway or Sweden.
I mean, I could spend the rest of my life kind of picking random parts of the world. There's various ones I'd like to go to before I fall off this planet. and it would be nice to get as many as possible. But I think for me it's a balance as well, because I run a kayaking business. I'm paddling most of the summer, and then it's my escape, ironically, is to go paddling or cycling or hiking. And so it's kind of trying to go somewhere that's a bit fresh and new, and develops your own ability and sort of horizons a little bit.
What sort of tip do you have for people who are keen to kayak? What's the one sort of like bit of advice you would give them?
Main thing I would say is not to get too hung up on kit, because kayaking is one of those sports that you can buy and spend a lot of money on. And you can have fun in a really cheap boat. You do need to get, obviously, the safety stuff, so a kayak, a buoyancy aid, paddles. If you're going on your own, spare paddles, a pump, and I would recommend a helmet as well. But you don't have to buy the sort of £1,000 ones. You can buy relatively cheap things. And as a beginner paddler, I always say, if you're practicing, practice with an onshore wind, somewhere that's going to blow you into a safe ground, not onto sort of cliffs or rocks or anything. And as long as you stay close and on shore winds, if you're a decent swimmer and you've got a buoyancy aid on, you'll probably get into shore if you get into trouble. Better if you can do something with a club or something like that. There's a lot of local clubs who will teach you really well as well. Or hire someone like me who will take you out and teach you. That's a shameless plug.
What's the company called?
Kayak Summer Isles.
There we go. Yeah. So I have a little confession, because your trip in Norway, a couple of years ago, had planned to do this kayaking trip around Lofoten. And I was very, very envious of when I was doing my research for this, to sort of see the sort of beautiful landscapes of Norway and the trip that you had up there. Very sort of briefly, I mean, how was it? So I can sort of imagine it and pretend like I was there.
Norway is basically northern Patagonia. It is amazing. The massive fjords. It's got, similar sort of thing. You can point a camera anywhere and it's beautiful. Anywhere you go, it's just wonderful. The culture's amazing. Seamus actually joined me on that trip as well. And to give a kind of background to this, when we planned Norway, Seamus and I planned Norway, we planned this in June, July. And that was our big trip, was to drive his van up to Nordkap, kayak a circumnavigation around Nordkap, and then go into Lofoten and just explore Lofoten with kayaks for a few weeks. On a whim, I then phoned Seamus and said, I'm planning this big Patagonia trip. Do you want to come down? And he sort of said, all right. And sort of drop tools, and that Patagonia trip became this big mega wild adventure. And Norway, which we'd planned and sort of paid for, then became almost kind of a post-trip debrief and a bit of a relax. And we were sleeping at the back of a van, we weren't in tents, it was pretty relaxed. And you're not going out for months at a time, you're going out for sort of days at a time. And so the whole mood of that trip for us was very chilled out, and although doing sort of interesting things in boats, it was kind of very much on our terms, and we got fortunate with the weather too. It was gorgeous out there.
I take it you went in the summer.
Yeah, so it was kind of June into July, so 24-hour sunlight. And in fact, Seamus liked it so much when we got to Nordkap, he got a job and stayed there most of the summer.
Not really surprised. I mean, as I was saying, and for anyone listening, it just looks like one of the most spectacular places.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much anywhere in Scandinavia really is fantastic. It's just a lovely culture, and the culture generally is very outdoorsy. So your average sort of person is very capable and equipped with doing stuff in the outdoors. Mm. And they love sharing that as well. They're lovely people.
Yeah. Big fan of Scandinavia. Well, Will, there's a part of the show where we ask the same five questions to each guest each week. First question is, let's get it up. On your trips, what's the one item or gadget that you always bring with you?
I'll not include the kind of practical stuff like tents and sleeping bags and things, because you need those on all the trips. The one thing that I carry with me that is completely and utterly useless, but very important sentimentally, is a compass, which is completely ruined.
For people listening, it's completely broken.
it doesn't point north. There's a large hole in the screen. That was actually from someone's crampon, which has a funny story. I lost it on a hill and somebody found it and through the power of social media got it back to me. And he found it attached to the bottom of his crampon. It's from 1914. It was my great-granddad's compass. And it's kind of been on every adventure I've been on.
Amazing.
But it's heavy and completely useless, but quite good fun to carry about.
Okay. What is your favourite adventure or travel book?
Favourite travel book? I will start with the one that really got me inspired to do my Scotland trip, which is Blazing Paddles by Brian Wilson. Subsequently followed, that was his account of kayaking around Scotland, I think in the 80s, late 80s. Really one of the first people to ever do so, and long before dry bags and technology and things were really kind of as they are now. And it's just beautifully written and really kind of captures it. I'd also probably say Moods of Future Joy by Alistair Humphreys, which was kind of one of the early travel books that I read that kind of gave me a sort of a bit of inspiration to go and do things out and around the world.
Yeah, he does come up with some pretty cool stuff now and again.
Yeah, and it's one of those books that it captures very well the little bits of expedition, the kind of the stuff that's not so interesting to focus on, like routine and the kind of small subtleties of things that people comment on and things happen to you. Think as simple as sort of getting up and making coffee when you're in a tent and that sort of stuff is often overlooked, but it can be a big part of your day when that's your routine.
Yeah, the last sort of big trip I did, we always used to wake up, make a cup of tea. God, that sounds so British saying that.
Essential. It is essential.
Yeah, essential. Yeah. It certainly wakes you up and starts the day right.
Absolutely.
Why are adventures important to you?
Adventures are important to me because I find they kind of ground you in your surroundings. I find going on a longer adventure allows you to really kind of immerse yourself in whatever discipline or place you've decided to be in. And it allows your body to slowly adjust and react to that. I find if you go in on a short trip, you can see things and you can push yourself to whatever limits you want, but you don't have the time to develop the routine in it that sort of embeds you into that adventure. And that over time slowly changes you as a person, and you basically are sort of making a new version of yourself in different surroundings slowly.
Oh, that's really nice. I haven't really ever thought of it like that, but it's very true. What is your favorite quote or motivational quote?
This one is from my dad, and he tells me every time I'm having a hard time on an expedition, which is, it's better to be Shackleton than Scott, and basically know where to call it. And that's often sort of rung into head. So that when you're going through a difficult time, you go, should I proceed or should I stop, sit and think about this? Like it's quite often better to sort of stop and think. Better still would be to be Amundsen, who was successful pretty much throughout his expeditions. Shackleton still had some fair epics, to be fair.
Who was it? Shackleton, he said it's better to be a live donkey than a dead lion.
Yes, something like that.
Yeah, something along those lines. I probably just butchered an absolutely another classic quote.
It's the modern version, it's better to be a chicken than a cock when you're doing stuff.
I always like that one. People listening are always keen to go on these sort of grand adventures around the world. What's the one thing you would recommend for people wanting to go on big grand adventures?
The one thing I recommend for people going on big grand adventures is to leave it a little bit open to what you actually want to achieve. The best adventures that I've ever sort of had were often the sort of side things that happened as a result of the initial plan. and sort of not to get target fixated, and I want to go and do this mission. Because if you're kind of there to do one thing, you often forget about all the other things surrounding it, and you don't have the time to enjoy that. And whatever you do, big or small, you want to take that sort of take the blinkers off and sort of remember that you're in these amazing places or you're doing something amazing and you should enjoy it for what it is. Even when you're feeling pretty grim about it, if it's hard, it is types of fun.
Yeah, I agree with that. We were speaking about it the other day, the idea of going quite on an open-ended adventure where you don't know too much about what's going to happen. You just sort of take it on a day-to-day. Because sometimes if you're so target-focused, as you said, you do miss those little moments, whether it's someone saying, come in for a cup of tea, or whether it's come in for dinner, or, you know, wanting to stop and chat. If you're so driven and focused, usually you miss those interactions, which end up being the most unique and what makes those expeditions really memorable.
Yeah, and a sort of an example from sort of personal experience was from my Scotland trip, being on my own. By the end of the kayaking, I got very... the last few months, you get very target fixated when you start seeing a goal. And I got very good at kind of doing distance and just putting head down and paddling. And of course, enjoying your surroundings to a degree, but you're kind of also sort of making ground as priority. And that held into the Patagonia trip where Seamus joined. And in the first couple of days, I kind of went into that and recessed back into that mindset of, okay, we've got A to B to do. Let's do A to B. And then Seamus sort of pointed out that actually, no, let's go and look in those bays and let's see what's around there. And sort of deviating and slowing down and sort of saying, I've never seen a penguin before. Let's go and have a look at that penguin. And stuff like that. And slowing down very purposefully. And initially for me, I found that sort of the first day or so a little frustrating, and then afterwards being like, oh no, he is completely right. That's what you're here for. You might as well enjoy it. You're probably never going to be there again.
Yeah, I think I was discussing with Geordie Stewart and saying, no one really cares how quickly you go unless you're breaking the world record for being the fastest kayak to go around Scotland. No one cares that you put in 100 miles or 80 miles.
Yeah.
It's really just about your own personal ambition.
Yeah, and it's kind of your memories and the memories that you can give to other people if you're in a group that are kind of what you want to produce. A record at the end of the day is just a bit of ego on the wall hanging at home.
Do you have one of those?
I don't officially, no. I could probably claim some if I hunted through, but it's never really bothered me.
Will, finally, you know, what are you doing now and how can people find you and follow your adventures in the future?
So at the moment I'm preparing as hard as I can to get my company back up and running, offering kayaking trips in the northwest of Scotland. If you want to join us, you can find us at kayaksunmiles.com or on Instagram, kayak.sunmiles. For my own personal adventures, I'm kind of looking a little bit ahead now to 2023 to do that Cape Horn trip. And you can follow me on willcopestatemedia.com or at willcopestate on Instagram. I look forward to seeing some of you out there if you ever come this way.
Well, we'll put a link to your Instagram and website on my website so people can follow you and find you. And Will, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing your stories. And
it's
as I say,
been a pleasure, John.
Fill me with a little bit of envy.
At the moment, like I say, I'm the same as everyone else, sitting at home. I'm building a shed as my big adventure, so I feel a bit envious of doing that stuff as well.
No, well, very soon we'll both be out.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Having big adventures. But Will, thank you so much for coming on today.
Been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the podcast on YouTube now, and don't forget to sign up for our adventure newsletter, which is in the description below. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, tag me on Instagram at John Horsfall. I'm always keen to connect with everyone. I hope to see you next week for another fascinating tale of adventure. But till then, have a great day and happy adventures.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.